a sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rehm, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on November 15, 1992, in the series Heroes in Clay, entitled Samuel, Culture Wars, Does God Take Sides? The scripture readings are 1 Samuel 8, verses 1 through 9 and 19 through 21, and chapter 12, verses 19 through 25, and Matthew 5, verses 1 through 16 and 43 through 48. The texts for the sermon are 1 Samuel 8, verses 19 through 20, and Matthew 5, verse 45. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
Last evening on the evening news, there was a brief bite of the heavyweight championship fight of the night before. And Riddick Bowe, who delivered the telling blow to Evander Holyrood. Okay, you got it. That's the guy. He got beat. Because Bo said, I won because God was on my side. Now that's really dumb. One guy beats up another, makes him bloody, and says, God's on my side. But it's really only kind of the extreme of what we all do at one time or another. We get in a conflict, we get in a debate, we get in a discussion, or we get into something that deeply divides, and we do our best to make sure that God is on our side. We make the claim. Samuel made the claim. Samuel believed that God was on his side, or maybe, in all fairness to Samuel, I should say that Samuel believed that he was on God's side. Samuel was one of the great leaders of ancient Israel, a good man, man of integrity and of spiritual depth, and he had been one of the judges of Israel at the end of that period of the judges. Israel was a tribal confederacy at the time, following the conquest of Canaan under Joshua. There was that period of time in which Israel lived as a kind of loosely confederated group of tribes, and they would rise up together for a common defense on occasion as God would raise up some charismatic leader who would rally them together, and then they'd go back and do their farming again in their respective tribal territories. They were a tribal confederacy. And we can understand that because we had 13 colonies at one time, or 13 states that were in a confederacy. The original 13 were in a confederacy. A confederacy is a kind of government where the independent units maintain a certain amount of autonomy, but they yield a certain amount of that to a centralizing, organizing power for such things as common defense and so forth. And remember your ninth grade civics class? At least 100 years ago, it used to be a ninth grade civics class where you learned about how the Confederacy moved into a strong central government. Wasn't it Alexander Hamilton who wrote the Federalist Papers and argued the case for the strong centralization of power? Well, that's all part of our history, and it's exactly what was going on in Israel at the time. Samuel had been an excellent judge and a great spiritual leader, and as long as you have a towering figure, the old forms and structures hang together somehow because they get an aura from such a figure as a Samuel. But now the situation is such that we're told in the 8th chapter of 1 Samuel that Samuel is old and his sons are not following in his footsteps. And so the elders of Israel, kind of the leading citizens, I suppose, come to Samuel. I hope they were a little more sensitive than the text says. It says, you're old. It's an awful thing, you know, when you start to get old. Somebody comes up and says, you're old. And your sons aren't doing well. Make us a king. And Samuel was displeased. And so he prayed to the Lord. And the Lord said, yes, I understand you're displeased, but recognize they're not rejecting you, they're rejecting me, and I'm used to it. It's been going on since I brought them out of Egypt. Listen to the people. And however, warn them what they're in for. And so Samuel does. And then we come to the ninth chapter, and it is as though we're reading a totally different account, because now we have Saul on the picture, and God speaks to Samuel, and he says, tomorrow there's a young man going to come. His name is Saul. I've appointed him to be a king. I want you to anoint him, and so forth and so on. And very interestingly, in the ninth chapter and the 16th verse, the Lord says, anoint him to be ruler over my people Israel. He shall save my people from the hand of the Philistines, for I have seen the affliction of my people because of their outcry has come to me. Now in the ninth chapter, you have another source. You've got another perspective. You've got another understanding of things. Here, very much parallel to Moses, you have God coming to Samuel and saying, this man is going to be my answer to meet the affliction and the suffering of my people Israel. Anoint him, appoint him, he will be my instrument in response to the cry of my people. Just like Moses heard this call from God, because God said, the cry of my people has risen to me, and I'm going to do something for them. In the ninth chapter, after that rather discouraging beginning about the initiative for a king, it seems as though that God is on the bandwagon. Now it is God who is doing this thing. Now God is saying, I'm going to move this tribal confederacy into monarchy in order to meet the needs of the immediate situation. Well, that whole section meanders between these two points of view. You have, we'll call it the Samuel source, the source that speaks for the old tradition, the old covenantal community, and you have the Saul source, which reflects the view of those who want to move into something new, to some kind of new social organization in order to meet the exigencies of the time. And both sides are sure that God is on their side. Neither side are pure. None of us are ever pure. No faith conviction of ours is without some measure of vested interest. You can count on that. Now, I think Samuel was genuinely upset about the undercutting of that ancient covenant community, where a people was gathered into a community, not through political alignment or economic philosophy or ethnic purity, but out of a trust in God, a common trust in God. But I think he also was hurt. He felt rejected. And those who were seeing where Israel had to go, they had a concern for the well-being of Israel, but they probably were also the ones who had been able to accrue some considerable bank accounts here and there, and they really wanted some kind of security system. They wanted to take the bull by the horns and make sure that the accumulated wealth and the position that they had acquired would somehow or other be secured. They wanted to be like other nations. So there's always that mixture. What's going on here? Well, I suppose it's a culture war. I don't know who introduced the phrase culture war, but I do know that it came into prominence in this past political campaign. Pat Buchanan at the Republican convention spoke about being at war for the soul of this nation. And out of the campaign has become an accentuation of that polarization of our society. And as we look back to Israel, we can see that polarization and culture divide wasn't devised in the 1990s. It's not a 20th century phenomena. It's been going on forever. There were two visions of what Israel was to be. There were two visions of what the identity and the mission and the nature of this community ought to be. And they were at odds. They were at war with each other. It's really interesting that in the biblical account, you don't have one set up as the right way and the other as the wrong way, but you have a weaving together of these two positions. Now, in the old way that we used to read the Bible, the old way I used to preach the Bible, frankly, I would have had to iron out those two undissolvable knots of material. I would have had to make one subservient to the other. I would not have been able to recognize that a biblical writer might have left in there intentionally an unresolved tension. But if you read the account, and you go home this afternoon and read chapters 7 through 16, that'll take you from the high point of Samuel's career to the enthronement of David. And you'll see that mixed message all in the meantime as the leaders say, give us a king. Samuel says, that is to forsake your trust in God. And the new people say, give us a king that we may go on into the future and be a nation like other nations. And God says to Samuel, yes, 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 Samuel, but on the other hand, listen to the people. It's a fascinating study. And the biblical writer is no fool. He didn't just cut and paste and put things together. This is intentional. This is an intentional effort to reflect as he looks back on Israel's history, the tensions and the conflicts and the movement that made them what they were and what they became. He is trying to listen to the voices of dissent and to see the way in which the uncanny presence of God moves in the unsettled, unstable, unpredictable human historical situation. It's a marvelous study of how Israel became the nation that it was. And the writer, in retrospect, portrays that for us so that we can see these tensions that existed within this ancient people of God. There's always been those who have clung to old values. What shall we call them? Shall we call them the Orthodox or the conservative? There have always been those who have felt that new times demand new solutions, that growing explosion of knowledge and new understanding and insight call for new arrangements. What shall we call them? Progressives? Liberals, maybe? There have always been those who have looked to the past in order to secure the present and the future. And there have been those, on the other hand, who, looking to the future, have recognized the necessity of scuttling the past as a straitjacket. In which camp would you have been? Would you have put your arm around Samuel and said, "You're right, old boy. Things are going to pot. And there may not even be a future if those radicals have their way. Everything's going to pot. No more morality, no more spirituality, no more God, secularism, secular humanism, etc." Or would you have been that the lobbyists who are pushing for the king, and would you have said, "Look, the future is here, and the new situation demands that we move out of this inherited confederacy that has served its time. It's time for a new form and a new structure to carry us into the future in order that we can be all that God would have us be." Where would you have been? Let's have an election. Shall we have another election? You can cast your vote. Why is it even important to look at this? Well, I think in this fascinating biblical narrative, seeing these tensions, we might get a word of enlightenment for the present situation in our own nation and society. For we are a nation deeply divided. We are a society that is polarized and poisoning each other. And everybody claims that God is on his or her side. There is a kind of conflict of moral visions about what this nation ought to be and what kind of society God is calling us to be. And that moral vision, held with passion, sometimes becomes violent. And there is name-calling and acrimony, and there is division, an adversarial spirit, a kind of polarization that fragments society and makes civil and rational discourse almost impossible. And so I think that it may well be that in this narrative we have some help to understand how we should negotiate these times. When I was at Brandeis 3 weeks ago, I met Professor James Davison Hunter. Didn't know at the time that he had authored a book, which was reviewed in the October Perspectives, by the way, Culture Wars. I picked it up a couple of weeks ago in New York. The Struggle to Define America, Making Sense of the Battles Over the Family, Art, Education, Law, and Politics. An excellent study. James Hunter is an evangelical Christian. He is an excellent sociologist. This is a very intelligent survey of what's going on in our nation, the things that are tearing our society apart. It's a good book. I would recommend it to you. Culture Wars. He uses the phrase. And he points out the peril in which our society stands. The potential fragmentation and the potential for the breakdown of all discourse, which of course is so essential for a democratic society. So we look at the biblical account. Might it not help us simply to recognize in the first place that these tensions are endemic to the human situation? So you're Orthodox. That's good. But that's not all. And so you're a wild-haired liberal. That's great. But it's not the whole picture. And the conservative and the liberal, the one who clings to ancient values and the one who reaches for that which is new and untested, need each other. And in a healthy society, there will be a creative tension with a strong enough center to hold people together. But I think it's simply important, first of all, to recognize, not despair, not throw up our hands, not as though that's the end of the world. We didn't invent this kind of polarization. Maybe the mass media and the television and the soundbite, maybe that accentuates, maybe that eliminates the possibility for reasoned discourse, for intelligible conversation. Maybe that polarizes and divides more than in earlier times. I think that's probably true. But nonetheless, we'll have to learn to live with that and to work with that. But if you are conservative and orthodox, you have every right to be thus. And it is your responsibility to hold true to values that are tried and true and to make sure that the treasures of the past are not lost. But yours is a good voice. But it's not the only voice. And if you are always champing at the bit and always on the growing edge trying to break through to something not yet gelling, then bless you. Keep everything unsettled and unstable. Be a nudging discomforter. But recognize that there are perils out there. As old Samuel said, you're going to get your king and you're going to get yours. And what we need in a healthy society is an acceptance of the legitimate and authentic tension that rests within any community of people. I like the way God is portrayed in this passage, in this whole narrative. I think I'd have to say that God is kind of a grudging progressive. That I say without bias. Oh, come on, where's your humor? He says to Samuel, you're right. You're right. But listen to the people. I think the narrative is saying you can't give up traditional values without some significant loss. But the nature of the historical experience is such that you have to keep moving on. Yes, they've rejected me. But listen to the people. Warn them, but listen to them. Give them their king. No arguing, no pouting, no raging, no manipulation, no coercion. God seems to be able to handle that which is so threatening to so many of us. God seems to be confident about the future and God's ability to cope with the future regardless of which alternatives are chosen. And then I love this. In Samuel's farewell speech in the 12th chapter, the people are rather humbled at this point and they say, pray to God for us. And Samuel could say this to them, for the Lord will not cast away His people, for His great, will not cast away His people for His great name's sake, because it has pleased the Lord to make you a people for Himself. Don't you love that? Isn't that the kind of God that you could worship? Samuel can say, look, this isn't some petulant, petty, capricious deity. This is Almighty God. This is the Creator of the heavens and earth. This is the one who has created us in His image, who will not let any of His children go. This God will not abandon you. This God will not forsake you. Stop quivering in your boots. Trust God. And God forbid that I should cease to pray for you. And I will continue to instruct you in the way you should go. And then if you follow the story on, there is also this, that as there is this normal, inevitable kind of movement, the values of the old tend to get incorporated into the vision of the new. Samuel anointed Saul king, and the new was here. But Samuel said, Saul, buddy, don't think you're a sovereign and absolute like all those puppet kings around you. Saul, you're just another citizen before the eternal and sovereign God. And you know the thing that made Israel unique, even when it became a monarchy, was the fact that its king always trembled before the prophet, that its king knew that he was accountable and that he had no absolute sway but must always regard the ways of righteousness and justice and seek the ways of peace. The old values, that community and tribal confederacy in covenant with God, that somehow or other got laced into the monarchy, so that when we reach chapter 16, we have David and we have the ideal king, and it would seem for all the world that God always intended that there would be such a kingdom and such a king, the golden age. Samuel wouldn't have dreamed that it could be so good. I read from the Sermon on the Mount this morning because it seems to me that as God's people, we are called to that kind of posture and spirit and attitude. I think one of the great problems in our present social unrest is the fact that we have politicized things that cannot be politicized. You cannot legislate morality. You cannot legislate spirituality. The things that tear us apart, abortion, homosexuality, the National Endowment for the Arts, family values, those trigger words that set off emotion, generate a lot of heat and very little light, they are not things that the government really can handle. Those are the things for us as the people of God to deal with. We as the people of God are called to live an alternative community. Jesus said, you are the light of the world. You are the salt of the earth. Light illumines, salt preserves. And we're called to be godlike. The God who causes the sun to shine on the just and the unjust and causes the fields of the righteous and the unrighteous alike to be watered with rain and snow. Jesus' final word is, so be like God. The word perfect in the RSV is not a good translation. The word is telos in Greek, which is the end or the purpose. Realize that for which God created you. God creating you in God's image. Be godlike. With a kind of universal benevolence. With a kind of love and a compassion. A justice and the seeking of love and fairness and finally peace in society. You be different. Don't let the sound bites polarize you. When you feel your anger begin to rise, recognize that God is not on your side. God is on your side and on the side of your adversary. Have a moral passion, but lace it with humility and express it with compassion, and simply be godlike. God knows. God can handle this alternative, that alternative, that alternative. When somebody tells you, this is God's way, don't you believe them. God is bigger than that, bigger than my vision and your vision, a vision that embraces us all and calls us all to be civil and committed agents of the kingdom that will surely come. Now, sorry, folks. God doesn't take sides.